Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad, John Robbins, in welcoming our extraordinary guest, Dr. Dean Ornish. Dr. Dean Ornish is founder of the Preventative Medicine Research Institute, and he's been a leading researcher on diet and health for the last 36 years. Dr. Ornish's program is the first based in comprehensive lifestyle change as opposed to drugs or surgery to ever be covered by Medicare. He is the author of 6 books that have all been national bestsellers. He's been appointed by Presidents Obama and Clinton to White House health advisory boards, and he's a former chair of the Google Health Advisory Council. The Ornish diet was rated number 1 for heart health by U.S. News and World Report in 2011, 2012, 2013, and 2014. He was chosen by Life magazine as one of the 50 most influential members of his generation, and by Forbes as one of the 7 most powerful teachers in the world. My dad and I both consider Dr. Ornish to be a treasured friend, as well as one of the great leaders of our times. So now, Dean, we're just so thrilled to have this time with you, and here for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Dean, for being with us. Again, your voice, your wisdom, and your love makes so much difference to our world, and I feel so much gratitude and inspiration from you.
Oh, thank you. Right back at you.
You have published, over the last few decades, one compelling study after another, showing that adopting the kinds of lifestyle changes you advocate can have dramatic medical benefits, including, of course, reversing the progression of heart disease. But late last year, you published a new study in Lancet, which is certainly one of the most respected medical journals in the world, showing that these very same lifestyle changes can begin to reverse aging on a cellular level. Can you explain?
Sure. First of all, thank you for the inspiring work that you and Ocean are doing, and I appreciate the chance to share our latest findings with your listeners in hopes that it'll help make a difference in their lives, too. We published a study 5 years ago, also in the Lancet Oncology, showing that the same lifestyle changes that we earlier showed for the first time that could reverse heart disease, and then we did a randomized control study showing that these same lifestyle changes, which essentially are a whole foods plant-based diet, yoga and meditation to control and manage stress, moderate exercise, and perhaps most important, love and intimacy and social support, which we can talk more about because I think it's so interesting. When Ocean introduced me as diet, and diet's important, as we all know, but in many ways, these other aspects are at least as important and perhaps in some ways more so. About 8 years ago, I went to a conference with the Dalai Lama, and Elizabeth Blackburn and Alyssa Apple presented their pioneering study showing that chronic emotional stress, women who were taking care of parents with Alzheimer's or kids with autism, and you certainly know how stressful that can be, the more stress they reported feeling and the longer they felt stressed, the lower their telomerase and the shorter were their telomeres. And telomeres, as you know, are the ends of our chromosomes that control how long we live. They control aging. They're sometimes likened to the plastic tips on the ends of a shoelace that keep your shoelace from unraveling, they keep your DNA from unraveling. And over time, as we get older, they tend to get shorter. And as they replicate, and each time they replicate, they lose a few base pairs, and so the telomeres get shorter. So they found that women who are under chronic emotional stress, the more stress they felt, the shorter their telomeres became. As a side note, it's worth mentioning that it wasn't the objective measure of stress. You could have two women who were in comparable life situations, but it was rather their perception of the situation that determined how stressful it was for them and how it affected their telomeres. In other words, if two women in similar situations, one was coping with it better because they were meditating or they had more social support, it didn't affect them as much. And so if you feel stressed, you are stressed. And that's important because we can't always control the environment we find ourselves in. You know, life can sometimes deal us some some crummy cards. But if we know that we're not a victim of that, we can actually do something about it, it can be inspiring.
What was so noteworthy about their study?
Their study made headlines because they found that comparing the low-stress and the high-stress women, that the high-stress women, they estimated, had 9 to 17 years shorter lifespan from that alone. So we had lunch, and I said, you know, if bad things make your telomeres shorter, maybe good things make them longer. And so we did a study 5 years ago, and we found that just after 3 months, and it's the same lifestyle program for all of these things, for reversing heart disease and prostate cancer and reversing diabetes. And we even found in a study at the same time in these same patients that over 500 genes were changed, turning on the genes that protect us and downregulating or turning off the genes that can lead to heart disease, diabetes, and particularly the what are called oncogenes that promote prostate cancer, colon cancer, and breast cancer were turned off, over 500 genes in just 3 months. It's so much more dynamic than we usually think about. But we also found that the telomerase, this enzyme that Dr. Blackburn discovered and got the Nobel Prize for it 4 years ago, that telomerase was increased by 30%. And that was the first study showing that any intervention could actually increase telomerase levels. So we followed those patients for 5 years. And then a few months ago, we published a study showing that the telomeres themselves actually got about 10% longer, whereas in the control group, they actually got shorter. And it was the first control study showing that any intervention, in this case the same lifestyle changes, could actually make our telomeres longer. Now, if this was a new drug that you could make your telomeres longer by 10%, it'd be a multi-billion dollar drug if that's all it did. But if it were a new drug that could make your telomeres longer, make your life longer, your heart disease reversed, your diabetes reversed, your prostate cancer reversed, and change your gene expression, it'd be a blockbuster drug. But again, these are the same simple lifestyle choices that we've been studying now for going on 37 years and that you've been writing about so eloquently. You know, we tend to think it has to be a new drug, a new laser, something really high-tech and expensive to be powerful. And what we're finding is that the more metrics we study, the more evidence we have to explain why these simple changes are so powerful and how dynamic these mechanisms are and how quickly we can improve.
The control group, actually, their telomere length decreased. While,
correct.
Yeah, the group that was following the Ornish protocol, it increased by 10%. Can you translate what a 10% increase in telomere length means in terms of decreased risk of disease or anticipated length of life?
Well, shorter telomeres are associated with an increased risk of pretty much everything bad, you know, whether it's dementia, heart disease, premature death from pretty much all causes. So we don't really know, I mean, if you want to be a purist about it, we don't really know what lengthening telomeres does because no one ever showed it before. So there's no way to really to know that except to extrapolate that if shorter telomeres make you live shorter, longer telomeres presumably would make you live a longer life. Now, we also did controlled study, but I was asked to go on the Dr. Oz show last May, and they wanted to pick out 6 of their most stressed out audience members based on questionnaire and then to put them through one of our lifestyle programs, which we can talk about as well, which Medicare is now covering. And so we put them through our program at the Beth Israel Medical Center in New York, and we decided on a lark to measure their telomeres because even Dr. Blackburn thought that if anything could actually lengthen your telomeres, it would probably take at least a year, if that, because, again, no one had shown it. And so just for fun, we did it after 10 weeks, and we found that we had usable data on 4 of the women. 2 of them didn't spit into the tube properly. And of the 4 that we had data on, 3 of the 4 showed increases in telomere length after just 10 weeks, and the other showed no change. And so I think these mechanisms are much more dynamic than we usually think about. And in the study that we published in The Lancet that we talked about a few minutes ago on the telomere length, one of the other interesting findings was that the more people change their lifestyle, the better their adherence to the lifestyle, our lifestyle program, the longer their telomeres were, which is what we found in all of our earlier studies, that the more people changed, the better they got, whether it was the amount of blockage in their arteries, the amount of prostate cancer they had, the number of gene expressions they had, their diabetes. The more you change, the more you improve. And that's a very powerful message for your listeners to hear, because I thought when I started doing this work that the younger patients who had milder disease would be more likely to show improvement, but turned out I was wrong. It wasn't how old or how sick they were the more they changed, the more they improved at any age in all these metrics that we looked at. And I find that a very empowering message, because so often people are told, oh, you've got bad genes, there's nothing you can do about it. Even President Clinton was told that when his bypasses clogged up, and I've been working with him since 1993, right after he became president. I sent him an email and I said, you know, the friends that I value the most are the ones who tell me what I need to hear, not what I want to hear, and you need to know it's not all in your genes. And I say that not to blame you, but to empower you, because if it were all in your genes, then there's nothing you can do about it. You'd be a victim, and you're the last person on the planet who's a victim. You're one of the most powerful people around. So that's when he began eating a predominantly plant-based diet. And again, whatever your politics, when a former president decides to make these changes, particularly one that wasn't known for eating particularly healthily beforehand, I think that sends a great message for everyone.
Has his health continued to improve?
It is. I just saw him a couple of months ago. He looked really great. I love him, and I hope that he sticks around for a long time, because he's still doing amazing work through the Clinton Foundation.
What's the next step with the telomere study? I mean, are there plans afoot for a large-scale randomized control trial?
Not with us. I've shifted my focus a bit. You know, I've been doing this work since 1977 for 37 years, and I thought if we just did good science, that would change medical practice, and to some degree it did, but not nearly as much as I'd hoped. And so we began training sites. I started a 501c3 nonprofit institute in 1984 when I moved to the Bay Area from Boston after finishing my medical training there. We began training through our nonprofit institute hospitals around the country. So we've trained about 53 of them so far, beginning with hospitals at Harvard, at Beth Israel, New York, at Scripps, at UCSF, in Omaha, Des Moines, Columbia, South Carolina, Fort Lauderdale, et cetera. And we got better clinical outcomes, bigger lifestyle changes, 85 to 90% adherence after a year, and even larger cost savings than anyone had ever reported. Blue Cross Blue Shield found that their overall healthcare costs were reduced by half in the first year, and then the heavier users, those that they spent more than $25,000 on in the prior year, they decreased their costs 400% by fourfold in the first year. So I thought that will really change medical practice. And then it was very painful, because what happened is that because we didn't have enough insurance reimbursement, a number of the sites began to close. And they all said the same thing. It's the best program we've ever had, and we're shutting it down because it's not financially viable because you don't have insurance coverage. And the painful lesson was that if it's not reimbursable, it's not sustainable for most people.
That is a painful lesson, but an important one. If it isn't covered, then very few people can benefit from it.
I didn't want this just to be concierge medicine and, you know, medicine for the wealthy. So I began a dialogue with, first we're going insurance company by insurance company, which is a very challenging way to do things, because people generally don't go into the insurance world because they're entrepreneurial or visionary. There are exceptions to that, of course, but not the norm. So I thought that was in 93, so I thought in 1994, if we could just get Medicare to cover this, then most of the other insurance companies would do so and follow their lead. I had no idea it would take 16 years to do that, especially since we had the support of not only President Clinton, but Newt Gingrich when he was Speaker of the House, across the political spectrum. We had 20 members of the Senate, from the most conservative to the most liberal, the same in the House, 30 people in the House, the representatives, the leaders of all the medical groups, and so on. It took us 16 years, but we finally did it. And they surprised me, Medicare, by doing this as a branded Dr. Dean Ornish program as opposed to a generic one that we were planning to give away, because they're so concerned about quality assurance and fraud and abuse and the usual Medicare things that they knew after 16 years of review that we'd do a good job. So I've been looking for a partner for the last 3 years to scale this with, and we talked to a number of the big pharmaceutical companies because they said that we really want to move into this area. I thought, well, gosh, they've got the resources, and if you really want to affect change, maybe they just go right into the heart of it. And then it became increasingly clear to me that the more successful we were in getting people off drugs, the more we were kind of threatening their core business. So long story short, in July we began partnering with a wonderful company called HealthWays. If you go to healthways.com, you'll see it. And they're in the wellness, well-being business. And so it allows us to partner with a group that has the resources and the infrastructure and the management team and, most importantly, the trust and integrity to do this properly. And so we've now been scaling this through hospitals and clinics and insurance companies around the country. Most recently, WellPoint, the largest insurance company in the country, within 14 states, 35 million members, is going to be not only covering our program, but marketing and encouraging their members to go through it. And that's important because we're really trying to create a new paradigm of real health care instead of sick care. And if it's reimbursable now, then it's sustainable. And because the people at Healthways really operate with a lot of trust and integrity, they've been fun to work with. And one of the reasons that I went with them, which is kind of a long-winded description of answering your question, is that we'll be collecting data on every patient who goes through the program. So we'll have a chance to collect data on hundreds of thousands, ultimately millions or even tens of millions of people who are changing their lifestyle. And the expensive part of doing studies like this is the intervention. You know, the Women's Health Initiative study cost somewhere between $1 and $2 billion, where they were looking at, 50 or 60,000 women and trying to get them to change. And they weren't really very good at getting them to change, and the control group changed almost as much, so they didn't really show what they had hoped to. But here, we can collect data on large numbers of people, and we know that they're able to make these intensive lifestyle changes, and we can then really look at all kinds of interesting questions, whether it's their telomeres or whether it's their adherence or their cost savings or their medical outcomes, any of a number of different areas. So I'm really excited both by the opportunity to do this work as well as the opportunity to collect the data.
This is thrilling, Dean. After all these years that you've been working on this, it seems like your work is on the threshold of moving to a whole new level of impact.
I think there's a convergence of forces, John, that really make this, finally, after almost four decades of doing this for you and me both, the right idea at the right time. You know, the limitations of high-tech medicine have become increasingly clear. The randomized trials continue to show that angioplasties and stents really don't prolong life or prevent heart attacks unless you're in the middle of having a heart attack, which most people aren't. That bypass surgery, maybe one out of 49 men who's treated with prostate cancer actually benefits. The other 48 are often maimed in the most personal ways. You know, they're impotent, so they can't have sex, and they're wearing diapers because they're incontinent for no benefit at huge economic costs. And drug treatments of getting your blood sugar down with, if you have diabetes, don't work nearly as well as getting your blood sugar down with diet and lifestyle. If you can get your hemoglobin A1C, a measure of blood sugar, down below 7 with lifestyle alone, as we've shown over and over again in thousands and thousands of patients, you can prevent all of the human costs, the horrible side effects of diabetes, the, you know, blindness and amputations and kidney failure and impotence and heart attacks and strokes and so on, as well as the economic costs, which are estimated by United Healthcare to be over $3 trillion a year in the next few years, simply by changing diet and lifestyle. At the same time, now that Obamacare, whatever you think of it, has survived the Supreme Court and the Republican government shutdown and so on, the incentives get turned on their ears. So before, the more surgery and stents and so on you put in, the more money you would make. Now, the fewer procedures you do, the more money you make, because you're given X amount of dollars to take care of somebody, and you, the doctor or hospital, get to keep what's left over. So I think it's an exciting time now that we can really create a new paradigm of real health care at a time when it's never been so badly needed.
I agree, and I am very grateful to you for your perseverance, 16 years, to accomplish something that is of such momentous importance. I know that just last month, Healthways, with whom you now have this partnership, signed an agreement with UCLA to bring your program in a really big way to Southern California.
That's right.
And I'm always delighted when I hear of another medical center or institute offering the Ornish program. How might those of our listeners who want to avail themselves of an Ornish program find out how and where they might be able to do so?
Oh, good question. Well, just go to our website. If you go to Ornish, O-R-N-I-S-H.com, which will take you to OrnishSpectrum.com, which my wife, Anne, designed, who has amazing ability to make everything and everyone around her beautiful, including our website, even me, and I've never felt beautiful before, has a listing in there of the sites that we're training, and it's expanding quickly. And we'll also be offering immersion programs at some sites where, even if you live in a place that's not geographically close to you, you'll be able to come and spend 12 days or so to go through the program that way.
That's great. That's really great. I want to shift our focus a little bit. I want to ask you about something. Cholesterol-lowering drugs, such as Lipitor, are among the most commonly prescribed drugs in the country. They are taken now by nearly 1 in 4 U.S. adults between the ages of 45 and 64, and they're taken by about half of those of us who are 65 and older. Recently, there were new guidelines issued by the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology that could, by some estimates, greatly increase the number of people taking these drugs. One study suggested that the number of people taking them could double, which is really staggering when you think about it. I have two questions.
Especially when you think about that half the population is already taking it, which if you double it, it's pretty much everyone.
It is. It is. It's staggering. And what I want to ask you is, do you think these new recommendations are overkill? And what is keeping people from paying more attention to another area of the new guidelines, which is growing recognition of the power of lifestyle changes?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because it's a little bit schizophrenic in a metaphorical sense. Well, one of the reasons why doctors prescribe cholesterol-lowering drugs so much is that they know that something needs to be done, but they don't really know what it should be. There are new guidelines, the same, you know, the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology, American College of Physicians, the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, all came out with a report 2 years ago that lifestyle changes and medical therapy should be the mainstay for most patients with stable heart disease, focusing on eliminating unhealthy behaviors. Now, that's a pretty radical shift for them. At the same time, their new guidelines are talking about essentially putting statins in the water supply, you know.
Yeah.
And the reason is that there's a common misconception that taking a pill is easy, taking a statin drug is easy, and everyone will do it.
I've often heard doctors say, my patients would never change their lifestyles, it's just too hard, but they will take drugs, so I prescribe them.
Yet if you really take an evidence-based approach, the pharmacy company's own data show that two-thirds of the people who are prescribed statins are not taking them just 3 or 4 months after they're prescribed. Two-thirds. Even if someone else pays for it, even if there's no side effects, which there often are. And you might say, well, why is that? If statin drugs are of proven value, at least for people who have heart disease, why aren't they taking it? And the reason is that they're fear-based. You know, the whole concept of risk factor reduction and even preventive medicine in many ways is fear-based, to the extent that take this pill, this statin drug, this cholesterol-lowering drug, to keep something really awful from happening 10 or 20 years from now that you don't want to think about anyway, like a heart attack or stroke, and so people don't. I mean, for, you know, a month or 6 weeks, they'll do pretty much anything their doctor tells them to do because they're scared, and fear is a great way of getting your attention, but it's not a sustainable way of getting your attention. For 4 to 6 weeks after someone's had a heart attack, they'll do pretty much anything that their doctor or nurse or dietitian or yoga teacher tells them to do. But then they tend to go back to their old patterns because it's fear-based. And whether it's in politics or whether it's in medicine, fear is not a sustainable motivator. Sometimes when I lecture, I'll say this goes all the way back to the first dietary intervention when God said, don't eat the apple, and that didn't go so well, and that was God talking. So we're not going to do better than that. But what does work is joy and pleasure and feeling good. And because these biological mechanisms are so dynamic in the ways we were talking about at the beginning of this conversation, most people find that they feel so much better so quickly when they make these changes in lifestyle that the irony is that it's actually more sustainable to make lifestyle changes than to take Lipitor. As I mentioned, two-thirds of the people who are prescribed Lipitor are not taking it 3 or 4 months later. But we have data now on over 4,000 people who have gone through our program in West Virginia, Nebraska, and Pennsylvania, which is the area for Highmark Blue Cross Blue Shield. And they're getting 85 to 90% adherence to our program after a year, as opposed to 30% adherence after 3 or 4 months to the drug.
I want to highlight what you just said because I think it's really important. You now have data for more than 4,000 people who have taken your program in West Virginia, Nebraska, and Pennsylvania. That's one red state, one blue state, and one that's right in the middle. These are mainstream Americans. And with these people, you've gotten a stunning 85 to 90% adherence rate after a year in your programs. Yet with people who take statins, the adherence rate is only 30% after only 3 or 4 months. This is highly, highly significant data. And it can seem almost counterintuitive because the prevailing belief has been that people won't change their lifestyles, but they will take drugs. What explains this, Dean? Why is the adherence rate so much higher for people who go through your program than for people who simply take drugs?
the difference is that the pill doesn't make you feel better, but the lifestyle changes do. And for many people, these become choices worth making. And the sicker they are, the more powerful and dramatic the changes are that we can measure. So, you know, there's a wonderful documentary film called Escape Fire that came out a couple of years ago. You can still get it on iTunes and Netflix and so on. Or if you just go onto our website, the Ornish.com website, it's all free. There's an excerpt from that and some others as well. It's a wonderful documentary about what's wrong with American medicine and what can be done about it. And they did a couple of segments on our work. And you hear stories like, man, I couldn't walk across the street without getting severe pain. And then, you know, a week after I went on Dean's program, I became pain-free, and I've been pain-free for 25 years. Or I was riding a wheelchair around Walmart. I couldn't have sex with my beloved because it hurt too much, you know. Or it took me an hour to take a shower because I had so much pain. I was taking 20 nitroglycerins a day, that kind of thing. And then within a week or two or three, they're essentially pain-free. That's powerful. You know, there's no point in giving up something that you like unless you get something back that's better. Fear is not a sustainable motivator, but joy is. When people make these changes, most people feel so much better, especially when their pain goes away. They say, well, you know, when I do this, I feel good. When I do that, I don't feel so good, so let me do more of this and less of that. Whereas the statin drugs like Lipitor don't make you feel better. At best, they don't make you feel worse, and you're taking it today in hopes that years later, something really awful that you don't want to think about doesn't happen, as opposed to something like changing lifestyle, which makes you feel better. And ironically, you know, we're getting reductions in LDL cholesterol comparable to what you get with the cholesterol-lowering drugs, but instead of spending, like the last year Lipitor was, before it went off patent a couple of years ago, $13 billion was spent on that one drug alone for things that you can accomplish essentially for free simply by eating and living healthier.
It's amazing, and I think that this is one of the reasons why your work is so important. The Latin root of the word doctor is actually docere, which literally means
to teach. Right.
And your medical practice, to my eyes, is exemplary in epitomizing this ideal. And I want to see it spread, and I delight whenever I see it happening that way. And I think it's the future of medicine. It really has to be. You mentioned one common misconception, and I thought of another one when you were speaking that I know you've written about. When people talk about diets, they usually are referring to weight loss programs. That's what the word diet typically means. And that's understandable. Two-thirds of us in the United States are overweight or obese. But the idea seems to prevail that the goal is to lose weight. And as long as you accomplish that goal, it doesn't really matter what you eat or how you get there. You've said that this is misleading. And I want to ask you, what are the dangers of believing that as long as you lose weight, it doesn't really matter how you accomplish that goal?
Well, let me put your question in a bit of a broader context because it's so important. We're not trying to get people to lose weight. We're not trying to get them even to reverse their heart disease. We're trying to get them to lead healthier lives. And when you lead a healthier life, everything gets better. We have better weight loss data than Weight Watchers, even though that's never been a primary focus of our work. And if you included the overweight people, it'd be way better than Weight Watchers. But if you include everybody, including the people who didn't need to lose weight, it's better than Weight Watchers. And Weight Watchers is doing good work. But we're finding that every metric we look at, we're about to publish a study showing that these same lifestyle changes reverse angiogenesis in people with prostate cancer. You know, they don't grow as many blood vessels to feed the tumors. You know, whatever metric we look at, people get better. Now, you might say, well, how can that be? I mean, when you think about it in the other direction, certainly we know that people who smoke, it affects all kinds of different diseases. That people, when you're stressed out, it affects all kinds of different diseases. And so it shouldn't be surprising that when you do things right, when you quit smoking, all kinds of diseases get better. When you manage stress and you eat healthier, all kinds of diseases get better. So it's not so much personalized in the sense of this prescription for this illness. It's more like general sets of living and being healthier that pretty much every metric we look at seems to get better. So, you know, you can lose weight in ways that are unhealthy. You know, chemotherapy is one way of losing weight. Smoking cigarettes, you can lose weight. Amphetamines or cocaine, you can lose weight. Don't recommend it. You know, I used to be in debates with Atkins or Gary Tobbs or people like that because they'd say, well, you can lose weight. And I say, yeah, but you're mortgaging your health. And as far as the Atkins and, you know, now the paleo and all these meat-based diets go, what's really lost in all of this is that the studies, they may show that you're losing weight, but you're mortgaging your health in the process. There was a wonderful article in the New England Journal by Stephen Smith a few years ago. And what they found was that if you look at the risk factors in some of these studies, that there may not be that much difference. But if you look at the actual, what happens to the underlying arteries, which is really the key, that when on a diet like I would recommend, the arteries are clean or they get better. On an Atkins-type diet, the arteries actually are more clogged, even if it's not reflected in the so-called traditional risk factors like cholesterol and blood pressure and things like that. And what they found was that on a high-protein Atkins-type or paleo low-carb diet, that the levels of what are called non-esterified fatty acids are twice as high as those who are fed a healthier diet. They have markedly lower numbers of what are called circulating endothelial progenitor cells.
What is this data telling us? What does this mean?
What this simply means is that the damage that it causes to your health when you go on these high-protein, high-animal-protein diets in particular, Atkins and Paleo and Gary Taubes and so on, are not reflected in their LDL and blood pressure and so on. But if you actually look at their arteries, which is really the bottom line, I mean, after all, high cholesterol is not a disease. At best, it's a risk factor for disease. The disease is what's happening in your arteries. And when you actually look at the arteries, this is what they found, that on a healthy diet like you and I would recommend, the arteries are essentially clean. And on a high-fat, high-protein, low-carb diet, they're clogged up because it's mediated through what are called these non-traditional risk factors. And that's why there's so much confusion. But I also want to talk just a moment about one of the things that you mentioned, which I think is worth talking about, is, you know, what enables people to make sustainable changes? And I mentioned earlier that if it's not reimbursable, it's not sustainable. But the other thing that I've learned is that if it's meaningful, it's sustainable. If it's joyful, it's sustainable. If it's fun, you know, you can force yourself to do pretty much anything for a little while, but it's hard to really make that sustainable. You know, all religions and all spiritual traditions have dietary guidelines, but they're different from each other. The general spiritual truths are not. You know, you find altruism and compassion and love and God in pretty much all spiritual traditions, but in as far as diet goes, you know, one religion you can eat pork, but not at another, or after midnight, but not before on Ramadan, or whatever it is. So it's like, what's going on here? Why are there so many different dietary recommendations? And what I'm coming to believe is that just the act of choosing not to do something that you otherwise might be able to do, whether it's food or sex or whatever it happens to be, imbues it with deep meaning. When we consciously choose not to do things that we otherwise can do, it makes them not only meaningful, but even sacred. When I was a kid, I used to think sacred was boring, you know, something dry and old and moldy and dusty and, you know, definitely not fun. And to me now, as I'm getting older, I just turned 60, I understand that sacred is just another way of describing what's the most special and therefore the most meaningful, the most intimate, the most erotic, the most exciting, the most ecstatic and joyful and playful and the most fun. You know, and if it's fun, it's sustainable. Even Bill Clinton, we were talking about earlier, you know, one of the reasons that he wanted to change his diet is that his daughter Chelsea was getting married and he wanted to dance at her wedding and walk her down the aisle and live long enough to see his grandkids born. Viktor Frankl, 50 years ago, wrote about two people in a concentration camp, and one, if they felt a sense of meaning that they had to get out of there, they wanted to see their kids or they wanted to write about it, whatever it happened to be, they were much more likely to survive that, just like the Liz Blackburn study of the women who were taking care of parents with autism or kids with Alzheimer's. That sense of meaning was one of the things that really changed, even on a genetic and chromosomal level, what happened to them. Is this making sense so far? I mean, I'm kind of going on here.
Oh, it's great, Dean.
You know, when you and I were growing up, many people believed in the more lovers you had, monogamy was boring and free love and all of that. And many people found that it was fun, but ultimately unfulfilling. You know, Ramakrishna 100 years ago talking about choosing a guru, but I think the same applies here. You can dig one deep well that reaches the wellspring instead of a lot of shallow wells that remain kind of dry and dusty. And that when you fully commit to someone, it's like digging a deep well. You know, it allows both people to feel that sense of complete trust in each other. And to me, trust is everything because it allows us to feel safe. And, you know, we can only be intimate to the degree we can make ourselves vulnerable, and we can only do that to the degree we feel safe. And when we feel safe, we can open our heart to the other person and be completely naked and vulnerable to them, literally and figuratively. And so we can experience these profound levels of intimacy that are so healing and joyful and creative and intensely ecstatic. You know, it's like all degrees of freedom are available to you when you're fully committed to them that way. And so when my wife Ann and I have a date, we're not trying to recreate a or replicate or imitate a, an experience we've had before. It's more like we're so secure in the love and the commitment that we're open to any possibility of what may happen in all degrees of freedom. And so it's always, you know, most of the time, I should say, 95% of the time, much more exciting than anything we've ever before experienced and anything we've ever even been able to imagine, because you can only imagine things that you've experienced before. And if you want to be open to new things, it's like that sense of commitment is paradoxically what enables that. So if I feel deprived because I can't eat this food, that leads to an ongoing struggle and a sense of being deprived, and that's not sustainable. If you say, I'm choosing not to eat this food because what I gain is so much more than I give up, that's sustainable. If I'm choosing to have sex with only one person, it's because what I gain is so much more than I give up. And it keeps it fresh. There have been a lot of articles I've been reading recently in the New York Times and elsewhere about these false choices. You know, am I going to get married and live with someone and be committed and kind of boring, and it's kind of routine and safe and, you know, but not all that exciting? Or do I want to go out and be single and not really have anybody to grow old with? And I say, wait a minute, that's a false choice. You can have both if you approach it in this way. It really changes the nature of the debate into one that makes it much more sustainable and much more fun.
Well, as you talk about the intimacy that you share with Anne, and I witnessed this, as did all the others who attended your beautiful 60th birthday party, and it, when you two danced together, it was just so beautiful.
We did our tango.
Yes. I'm thinking about the connection between intimacy and social connectedness and health. And I know this is a fundamental pillar of your program and of your life. And when you talk about wanting practices and health strategies not to be fear-based, because that isn't sustainable, but to be based in joy and love and connection, I understand that power. And I wonder if you could speak for a moment to that connection between intimacy and a feeling of belonging and connection with others and the actual medical value of that.
Well, it goes back to earlier, you were talking about the translation of doctor is one who teaches, and the word yoga comes from the Sanskrit to yoke, to unite, to bring together. The word health comes from the word to make whole. You know, these are very old ideas. I didn't invent them. I'm just realizing how powerful they are. I wrote a book about this, I guess, 16 years ago called Love and Survival, and I reviewed what at that time were hundreds and now thousands of studies showing that people who are lonely and depressed and isolated, which I think is the real epidemic in our culture, and that's how I got interested in doing this work when I was a freshman in college, without my own sense of depression. When people are feeling lonely, depressed, and isolated, they're 3 to 10 times more likely to get sick and die prematurely than those who have a sense of love and connection and community. In part because you're more likely to abuse yourself. People are more likely to smoke and overeat and drink too much and work too hard and so on when they're feeling lonely and depressed, but through mechanisms we don't fully understand as well. Nicholas Christakis more recently found that we're so interconnected that if your friends are obese, you're 45% more likely to be obese. If your friend's friend is obese, it's 25%. And if it's your friend's friend's friend that's obese, you're 10% more likely to be obese, even if you've never met them. And it's not just obesity, it's pretty much everything. That's how interconnected we are, for better and for worse. So although when you talk about Dean Ornish, most people think diet. To me, diet is obviously important, but it's the least interesting part of it, in part because of how I got interested in doing this. I mean, if you told me when I was depressed and 19 that I would live longer if I just ate healthier, I'd say, you don't get it. I'm just trying to get through the day, like so many people. So I've learned that information is important, but it's not sufficient for most people. If it were, nobody would smoke. It's not like a doctor says, hey, did you know smoking is bad for you? And the patient goes, I didn't know that. Thank you. I'm going to quit today. But it's like you have to say, why do you smoke and overeat and drink too much and work too hard and so on? And people say things like, I've got 20 friends in this pack of cigarettes and they're always there for me and so on. So what I'm finding is that in our work, it has 4 aspects. It's the diet and exercise, but also the yoga and meditation. But perhaps most important is the love and intimacy part, the 4th component. And so we have what are called support groups, which started out as more traditional support groups in terms of helping people stay on the diet, for example. And I quickly realized in my very first study back 37 years ago that I'd unwittingly created something much more powerful, a safe environment for people to let down their emotional defenses and to talk openly and authentically about what's really going on in their lives without fear that somebody's going to, you know, make fun of them or abandon them or reject them or give them glib advice or any of those kinds of things. And so it's so transformative. It's why we're getting 85 to 90% adherence to our program after a year, why 25 years after a study ends, they're still meeting once a month, because, you know, that's the real epidemic in our culture. Many people don't have a place where they feel safe that they can connect at a deep level with other people. And it's so meaningful that it, as I mentioned before, if it's meaningful, it's sustainable, and it's what enables people to, it's the part of our program that people often have the most anxiety about or the least belief it's going to make a difference, and almost invariably it's the part that really ultimately becomes the most meaningful for them.
Yes, and I think there's something about our society that trains us to think of ourselves as separate, and we're supposed to do it ourselves, and we're not supposed to be dependent, and we're supposed to be self-reliant, and so take this pill. But the healing that takes place when we are able to genuinely and authentically connect with other people and join together, have their support and give them ours, is far greater, far more sustainable, and as you've shown, far more effective. I think this is one of the keys that underlies the efficacy of your work, is that it's love-based.
It's love-based. It's a conspiracy of love is what we sometimes say. If I went to Medicare and said we want to teach people how to, you know, open their hearts and love each other and love themselves and quiet down their minds and body to experience inner peace and joy, they'd say, you're out of here, buddy, you know. But even then, it took 16 years with all the angiograms and PET scans and quantitative arteriograms and radionuclide ventricular grams and all these kind of state-of-the-art tests. It still took us forever. I told someone else it took us 16 years to get Medicare to cover our program. They said, only 16 years? So it's all relative in a sense. But that's part of what makes it meaningful, is that it's hard, but also because it's empowering people with what really matters. I mean, again, I got profoundly depressed when I was in college to the point of almost killing myself because I didn't have that sense of meaning. I realized that meaning is malleable. You know, I could take meaning out of anything. You know, so what, big deal, who cares, you know, why bother, you know, what I call seeing the world through shit-colored glasses. It's like, you know, it's like when you're just having a bad day, you think, I had a bad day, but things will get better. When you're truly psychotically depressed like I was, it's like you feel like you're really seeing things clearly for the first time, that things are bad, they'll always be bad, they've always been bad, and anytime you thought they weren't, you were just fooling yourself. And that's where that sense of profound helplessness and hopelessness comes from, because you have this really reality distortion feel that you're really seeing things in a very negative way. I could take all the meaning out of anything. But I also learned that I could put the meaning back into anything, and I could choose to make things meaningful. And one great way to create meaning is by choosing not to do things that you otherwise could do, that, as we talked about earlier. I'm not going to eat this food because it's better for me, it's better for the planet. You know, I'm not going to eat meat because, or I'm not going to eat meat on Mondays, you know, or I'm not going to eat meat after 6 p.m. like, you know, Mark Bettman, or I'm not going to eat, or before 6 p.m., or whatever it happens to be, you know. Whatever you do, there's a corresponding benefit. It's not all or nothing. It's not black and white.
I hear you saying that there are a whole spectrum of choices, and the key is to create meaning, to live a life of meaning. And one of the ways that we can do that, one of the ways we can generate meaning in our lives, is to forego certain foods on behalf of a higher purpose, which could be our health. Could it also be some other higher good, such as the welfare of animals or the health of the planet?
If I say I'm going to eat less meat because more global warming is caused by livestock consumption than all forms of transportation combined, that makes it meaningful, and it's good for me as well. Or I'm going to not eat these foods because I love my kids and I want to live as long as I can to watch them grow up and to be there for them. So I can take meaning out, I can put meaning in, and it's way more fun to put meaning in than to take it out. And as I get older, I'm realizing I have a lot more choice about these things than I ever realized. I mean, that's why I love this work, because you can change your gene expression, for goodness sake. I remember I brought Swami Satchidananda to speak at the medical school when I was a medical student, which was pretty radical back then. And he said, oh, you can change your genes if you meditate and eat healthier. And I thought, oh, God, now I've really done it. Now they're going to really laugh at me, and they're all going to think what a stupid idea this whole thing is. And even I thought it was kind of stupid that you could change your genes, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. But sure enough, you could. So people used to say, oh, what you're doing is so touchy-feely, and it's about love and all that kind of stuff, and that used to bother me. And then one day I just owned it. I said, yeah, you know what? It is touchy-feely. It is very loving. That's what makes it work, because we are touchy-feely creatures. We're creatures of community. That's how we've survived as a species all these years. And with the breakdown of the social networks that used to give people that sense of connection and community, anything that brings us together is not only healing, but it's also meaningful, which is what makes it sustainable.
Dean, your love for this work that you do is contagious and inspiring and beautiful.
Thank you.
I thank you. And I, on behalf of all of our listeners, really on behalf of the planet and all human beings and all of life, I thank you, because the power of your work goes to the heart of our problems and issues as people, and it heals our physical hearts, as you've demonstrated over and again. It's also healing our greater heart, our spiritual heart, our capacity to love each other and ourselves and life itself. So really, thank you, Dean. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John, for your important work and Ocean, what you're doing. I feel blessed to know you as friends and to be a small part of what you're doing. You know, awareness is always the first step in healing, and this series is going to help reach a lot of people with information that I'm hoping can be meaningful and transformative for their lives, as it has been for me and for so many people that I've worked with over the years.
We've been talking with Dr. Dean Ornish, who is a powerful, life-changing clinician, researcher, advocate, and also has a heart that has touched millions of lives. Dean is founder and president of the Preventive Medicine Research Institute. He's the author of 6 bestsellers, including Dr. Dean Ornish's program for reversing heart disease. Dean, we're so grateful to you for your work, which, of course, is changing the course of medical history. We also appreciate your loving service to humanity and the millions of lives you've touched. And we thank you for taking the time to share so many important insights with us today.
Thank you, dear friends.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 23 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources. If you like, you can also get CDs, members-only courses, and a lot more. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thanks so much for joining us in the Food Revolution. What do former United States President Bill Clinton and the famous movie star Samuel L. Jackson have in common? Well, they both credit the work of Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn for helping to transform their diets and change their lives for the better. Regardless of what you think of his politics, President Clinton's very public food revolution story has inspired a lot of people. What we have to share with you now is a short interview where the president talks about his dietary changes and how they have impacted his life.
How did you lose so much weight? What kind of diet are you on?
The short answer is, I went on essentially a plant-based diet. I live on beans, legumes, vegetables, fruits. I drink a protein supplement every morning, no dairy. I drink almond milk mixed in with fruit and a protein powder, so I get the protein for the day when I start the day out. And it changed my whole metabolism, and I lost 24 pounds, and I got back to basically what I weighed in high school. But I did it for a different reason. I mean, I wanted to lose a little weight, but I didn't dream this would happen. I did it because after I had this stent put in, I realized that even though it happens quite often that after you have bypasses, you lose the veins because they're thinner and weaker than arteries. The truth is that it clogged up, which means that the cholesterol was still causing buildup in my vein that was part of my bypass. And thank God I could take the stents. I don't want it to happen again. So I did all this research, and I saw that 82% of the people since 1986 who have gone on a plant-based, no dairy, no meat of any kind, no chicken, turkey. I eat very little fish. Once in a while, I'll have a little fish. Not often. If you can do it, 82% of the people who've done that have begun to heal themselves. Their arterial blockage cleans up. The calcium deposit around their heart breaks up. This movement has been led by a doctor named Caldwell Esselstein at the Cleveland Clinic, Dean Ornish and Minoa in California, the doctors Campbell, father and son, who wrote the China study, and a handful of others. But we now have 25 years of evidence. And so I thought, well, since I need to lose a little weight for Chelsea's wedding, I'll become part of this experiment. I'll see if I can be one of those that can have a self-clearing mechanism. We'll see.
I hope you're healthy for many years and get to see grandchildren for many years.
Me too. That's really the big deal. You know, Hillary and I, we're happy. We love our son-in-law and we admire him, but and we'd like to be around. If there's grandkids, we want to be there to do our part.
Mr. President, good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks for what you do.
Now here is a fun clip of President Clinton's interview on the Late Night Show with David Letterman.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
You and I don't want to sound silly about this, but you look wonderful. You look better than I've ever seen you in my life.
You know, when you get to be our age,
mm-hmm.
about all you got left is bright clothes and BS, and you got a corner on the BS market. So I had to do this.
Yeah, I do. But you and I have a similar health history. We both had some fairly invasive surgery, and I've been struggling with my weight. You have conquered your weight. What are you doing? How do you do it? Why can't I do it?
Well, I haven't really. I mean, I'm about 5 pounds overweight now because I've been working so hard, and I haven't been out doing as much exercise as I need. But I gave up meat and dairy and virtually completely gave up fish. I just went on as close to a vegan diet as I could get and still traipse around the world.
Wow. Well, see, I don't want to do that.
But look, here's the problem that sort of 2 minutes. Everybody produces an enzyme that destroys all the bad cholesterol we produce. Almost everybody produces some extra. Problem is, you can't get a test that'll give you how much extra you have.
Mm-hmm.
So when you and I had to have our heart operations because of blockage, we know we didn't have enough to consume whatever it was we were consuming to live however we were living before then. And then when I dropped that vein and had to have the stents put in, I just decided I'd like to hang around, see if I become a grandfather, or do a few other things. And so I changed my diet to try to drastically cut down on my cholesterol intake so this would never happen again.
Well, congratulations. It's certainly working. See, my problem, things have gone so well for me health-wise that I think I can fudge. You know what I mean? I feel like I've got an advantage, so how about a pound of fudge? You know, literally. But that's not why you're here. Anyway,
you can't fudge, just not too much.
Yeah.
But even, you know, Dr. Esselstyn, who has the most poorly militant position, I mean, he doesn't even eat things made with olive oil. And he looks great. He's about 10 years older than we are. But he has a piece of chocolate every New Year's Eve. So he fudges.
Every New Year's Eve. He goes crazy New Year's Eve, has a bite of a Snickers.
Sometimes you got to let it all hang out.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton's daughter, Chelsea, was recently asked how she felt about her father's food and health journey and how the work of Drs. Ornish, Esselstyn, and Campbell, all of whom are speaking in this Food Revolution Summit, had impacted his life. This is what she had to say.
Doctors talk about the women's disease, when women push the men in the family to go to the doctor and get healthy. Did you and your mom pressure your dad to get healthy when he had his heart surgery? And did that inspire you to work so much with health now?
Well, it's a great question. I have to say I'm very grateful that my father decided to get healthy, that he didn't need my mom or me to pressure him to do that. I think having a quadruple bypass surgery
gets your attention.
Sufficiently sobering. And I am profoundly grateful, back to gratitude, that he really radically changed his life. He's probably the world's most famous vegan.
Right.
He walks 4 times a week diligently wherever he is in the world. And he is so determined to be an advocate for other men, and men in particular, to go to the doctor as he did when he started to not feel well, and then to make the necessary changes in their lives so that hopefully they can live a long time.
If you'd like to comment on what you've been hearing or to share questions or hear insights from other summit participants, please check out the comments section at the bottom of our broadcast page. You will need to make sure to refresh the page in order to see the most recent comments. Our next presentation will be a teleconference interview with heart health pioneer Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn. It will start at the top of the hour. Until then, this is some music from our friend Bruce Beckvar.